Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and this week we're looking at education policy. Should there be faith schools, and should there be private schools, and how should we decide such issues?
Hello, my name is Jennifer Hudson, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. Many of the most important policy decisions that a state can make relate to education. What kind of education should children receive? How far should parents be able to dictate that choice? Is it acceptable to have schools that instruct pupils in a particular religious faith? Should elite private schools be allowed to exist? And, given that such schools do exist, can socially progressive parents send their children there with a clean conscience? My guest today has been exploring these and many other related questions for decades. Adam Swift is Professor of Political Theory here in the UCL Department of Political Science. He's a prolific scholar with books that include Educational Goods, Values, Evidence, and Decision Making, written with Harry Brighaus, Helen Ladd, and Susanna Loeb. Family Values, The Ethic of Parent-Child Relationships, also with Harry Brighaus. And How Not to Be a Hypocrite, School Choice for the Morally Perplexed Parent. As a parent who's looking at secondary schools for her daughter, I think I might have a question for you here, Adam. Adam's work on education starts with the basic principles of political theory. And from these principles, he draws out key implications for policymakers and parents. Adam, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. Before we get to these basic principles, could you just give us a little bit of background? What sparked your interest and research in this area in the first place?
Yeah, well, I like to think that it all started when I was 7 years old and my family moved from one bit of London to another bit of London. So we'd lived in Highbury, which then was a working class neighbourhood. And I went to a primary school on the same road as Arsenal Football Stadium. And when I was seven in 1968, we moved to Hampstead, which, as some of your listeners will know, is a much more affluent and more privileged part of London. And I remember just noticing the difference at my primary school. So, for example, at my primary school in Highbury, I was, I think, the only kid who could read in my year. And I remember going up to the higher classes to help teach children to read. And when I went to the school in Hampstead, everybody could read, pretty much everybody could read. And it was just so kind of apparent that these children had very different upbringings. And that was kind of the beginning. And then it was a very live issue in the 70s, kind of what should happen to secondary schools. The Labour Party was talking about abolishing elite private schools. And it was just something I was always been interested in. And then I went to university and kind of got interested in social justice theory generally, did a master's in sociology, where I got kind of pursued my interest in understanding social mobility. And then it kind of all came together really from that kind of mixture of personal experience and then academic research, I guess.
It's really fascinating, I think, for listeners to hear that kind of personal experience that informs the research and that really motivates people well into their academic careers. Let's start with some of the research. Your work is based on the idea that answers to the sorts of questions that I listed in the start of this podcast should be rooted in a set of principles. Can you briefly describe for our audience what those principles are?
So I guess the way I think about education in general is that it has two kind of key aspects. It plays a massive role in our society. It both forms us as the people we become. So we can think of education as the process by which children, from the moment they're born, kind of, there are these formative influences on them, which we call education, some of which happens in schools, but not all of which happens in schools. But that's kind of like really, there's a whole set of principles to do with who should be forming them, who gets to decide what kind of formation children should have, what's the proper role of the state, what's the proper role of the family, what are children's interests that should be protected. So that's one kind of area. And then the other area, which is where I really first got into it, is actually to do with distributive questions, really questions of social justice and distributive justice. you know, it looks like the distribution of opportunities to do well are very unequally distributed as between children born into different families. It looks like it's pretty clear that the school system kind of plays a role in reproducing those things. So the kind of principles are involved on both the formative side and the distributive side. That's the kind of overall picture. I don't want to go on for too long, but the basic idea, the way I think about it, is we need to think about what properties or capacities in people do we want an education system to produce, and these me and my colleagues call educational goods. What are the good things that we want education to produce? And we often think about the most obvious one that governments seem interested in is people's capacity for economic productivity. So it looks like a lot of education policy, you know, we know about this, life in universities is geared towards training, developing human capital, with an emphasis on kind of what are the needs of the economy. But really, we don't want education only to be about that. Hardly any of us would kind of buy into such a limited view. We want education to do other things. For example, we want it to promote people's autonomy. We want people to be equipped with the skills they need to kind of make their own lives in the way that they choose as best, you know, subject to the kind of obvious limits. And then there's also kind of civic and moral capacities that we want people to have. We want to, and this is very salient at the moment in the university world, you know, this decolonizing the curriculum. I was at a seminar this morning on that. That's partly about inculcating certain kinds of attitudes and contact between people from different kinds of backgrounds. So these are all part of the mix in education. So these are the goods we want education to produce. But then, as I've said, we also have to care about how those goods are distributed. So there's a kind of set of distributive principles. Some people think equality is the relevant distribution that we should be looking for. Some people think, no, it's not really about equality. It's much more about making sure everybody has enough, a kind of adequacy standard of education. And some people think that really the best way to think about distributive questions is by focusing on the interests of the least advantaged. So how should we distribute educational goods, access to education, if our aim is to kind of improve the well-being of those who are least advantaged in the society? And that all that is what we call consequentialist, because all that is really to do with the kinds of goods we want our society to have, the kinds of flourishing we want people to enjoy in their lives, and how those goods and that flourishing is distributed. The other part of the story is that there are also what we call non-consequentialist considerations. For example, the rights that parents might have to decide how their children are educated, irrespective almost of the consequences. So their concern may not be to promote any kind of social good. Their concern may not be even to promote their own children's good. It may simply be that they feel this is their child and it's for them to decide kind of how the child is educated. On the other hand, and this is a key focus of my research and my colleagues' research, there are children's interests and children's rights at stake here that need to be, in our view, protected, and in our view, need to be protected a lot more than they currently are. So on the one hand, we've got these consequences, these goods, these distributions that we're trying to kind of get an education system to produce. And on the other hand, we've got these rights that we must respect, but we've got to correctly identify kind of the proper limits on those rights.
That's really fascinating. And it kind of makes me want to ask one more question before we move on to some of the practical applications. You know, as a scholar and thinking about these different criteria, is there a kind of a weight? Is there a priority? How do you privilege the different types of considerations or principles that you're weighing to know which is more important? Is it more important that parents have their preferences accounted for, or that we protect children's rights, or that whatever distributive goals that we have for education, that is kind of prime in this bigger model or equation of figuring out what is the right policy?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. That's kind of the $64,000 question for people who do the kind of stuff I do. A kind of mentor of mine, a philosopher called G.A. Cohen, Jerry Cohen, once wrote something like, you know, we're really good at knowing what kind of ingredients should go in the cake, but how exactly they should be combined, how they should be weighed to kind of get the cake exactly right, that's another question. What we try and do in our work, which I hope we'll talk about later, especially about religious schools, is we try and offer a kind of a reasoned account of the best balance in our judgment between these different considerations. But that's all we can do, is kind of notice all these different kind of normative considerations that are in effect being weighed against each other. I think rights have a special status. So typically rights don't just go in the mix in the same way as these other kinds of concern. You know, if children have a right to, for example, develop their own autonomy, then that's a pretty hard constraint. What that means is that, you can't, just to get a better distribution of something else, you can't, you know, infringe or violate the right that the child has. So rights kind of have this special status, but even so, there then can be kind of conflicts between alleged children's rights, alleged parents' rights, and so on.
That's really fascinating, Adam, and you, I think, set out the broad framework really well. Let's try and see how this works out in practice by looking at applications to two concrete examples which have featured in your research. The first is about private schooling. And the question I want to start off here is, you know, what are the arguments that we need to consider in weighing up having private elite schools versus kind of public comprehensive schools? And what's your analysis? Where do you come down on the role of private schooling in modern democracies?
Right. Well, I mean, my view, I think it hasn't really changed since I was seven, I guess, is that there's some kind of something pretty obviously unfair about allowing children's prospects in life to depend on the wealth of their parents, and also perhaps just on the choices of their parents too. And so I believe in something, a kind of principle of fair equality of opportunity or something like that. And I don't hold that absolutely. I think that there are reasons why we shouldn't pursue fair equality of opportunity kind of all the way. Reasons to do with respect for the family and the institution of the family and the particular values that familial relationships kind of can realize, for example. But I guess I don't see any good arguments for allowing elite private schools that would be sufficient to make us say, okay, we know they create all this unfairness, but still we've got to have them. And that really boils down to the thing I was saying before about kind of a correct analysis of parents' rights. So the main theme of my work on education, both with respect to elite private schools and with respect to religious schools, the kind of the main thrust of it has been to suggest that we are over-deferential to parents. So we mistakenly, in my view, believe that parents have rights to direct their children's lives and to do things for their children that, in fact, we don't have to allow them to do. So we allow parents, there's a kind of phrase, you know, we allow parents to do things both for and to their children, that we do that because I think we mistakenly believe that this is part of the right that parents have. And quite a lot of my more recent work has been trying to delineate the exact proper space for parents' rights. And one implication of that, or in fact, it came the other way around, an early view was that parents don't have a right to send their child to a private school. And so that's my view. My view is that we shouldn't have them, because, and it's quite easy to see all the downsides, I think. And I think the best argument by far is, well, even though there's all these downsides, you just can't interfere with parents' right to send their kids, spend their money on them if they want. And I think the answer to that is, well, actually, that's not right. We can, and we would be justified in doing that.
Let me ask you about, because I imagine that argument would have gotten a lot of pushback, from not least from parents, but I mean, it goes against this kind of, I think, deeply held value that parents have their children's best interests at heart, and that is the kind of primary locus of where decision making should take place. But when you talk about a parent's right to send their child to school, can you talk, you know, give our audience a little bit of balance and relativities in terms of how you see that vis-a-vis a child's right to have, you know, an educational experience that gives them equal opportunity or opportunity of chance? And is there a right of the state to enforce or to have better distributive kind of outcomes here? So where do those rights fit in your mind?
Yeah, good. Yeah, so that's kind of exactly how these debates go. So yeah, so I think it is the proper role of the state to create something of a level playing field between children born to different families. You know, one way of thinking about that, so some of our audience will have heard of John Rawls and his kind of theory of justice as chosen behind a veil of ignorance, where people don't know who they're going to be in the society. And Rawls thinks that if you don't know who you're going to be in the society, you don't know if you're going to be born rich or poor, into a wealthy family or whatever, then one of the principles you would want to regulate society is what he calls a principle of fair equality opportunity, which says your prospects in life shouldn't be influenced by the class or social background of your family. And he knows that in practice it will anyway, but we should at least, whilst respecting the family, we should do as much as we can to kind of level the playing field. And it is that this is a principle of justice. It's the state's job to uphold justice on this kind of vision. They must do that whilst respecting parents' rights. So if parents had the right to spend their money on education in the same way as they have the right to spend their money on cars or eating out or whatever, then that would be something we should respect. But there isn't, I don't think, a plausible view that this interest in getting to spend money on your children's education. This is all within certain contexts. So I do think that parents have a right to make sure their children's education is good enough. And in the real world, that may sometimes justify parents opting for an elite private school. Might do. You mentioned one of the books I read, How Not to Be a Hypocrite, right? That book is all about the kind of the difference between the societal level issue of what kind of school should we have and the individual level issue of what kind of school is it justified for me to choose for my kid given the circumstances I face. So some parents may judge that the schools that the state's providing for them are not adequate and not good enough. I think in lots of countries that will be true. Mm-hmm. And maybe in some places in the UK that may be true. And then it may be actually that parents are justified in, if they can, opting out of state provision in order to make sure their kids' education is good enough. But that, on my view, doesn't yield the conclusion that we should allow elite private schools at the systemic level. Because I think if we didn't have elite private schools at the systemic level, more schools would be good enough. Because my analysis of how elite private education works is that it's detrimental to the state system, which is, after all, where 93% of 93% of children go is in the state system.
Let me pick you up on, I think, maybe challenges to those who would contest that we shouldn't have elite private schools, or should contest that we should have them. You just mentioned that the presence of these elite private schools are essentially driving down the quality of public schools. And you talked about in some of your research the kind of absolute difference between the two experiences. And so I guess, how would you reply to the argument that some people might say, well, elite private schools are actually kind of raising the collective bar of the educational experience. And it's providing, some students a better overall experience, and it's allowing other public schools to kind of catch up or look at them as a model. So talk to our audience a little bit about that kind of absolute versus relative experience that you bring out in your research.
Right. So I think it could be that investing more in some children's education than in others, even at school level. I mean, we do this clearly at university level. As a society, we just make decisions to invest in more able students or people who have done better in the school system. They get to go to the better universities, where even now there is still kind of residual public funding going into those. So I'm open to the idea that I'm not proposing we should invest equally in all children's education. Some people do propose that. And the reason is that it could well be that some children will benefit, even children who are kind of on the wrong end of these inequalities may in the long run benefit from allowing the inequalities. So it may be that investing more in some children than others would be beneficial for the children who aren't invested in even. But that's not going to get you to the conclusion that we should allow individual parents to invest in their individual kids. I don't think that might get you into a kind of a meritocratic state system, like I think they have in quite a lot of countries, where they try and identify the most able and they invest extra resources in them. It's quite a competitive system, and they will justify that in the long run everybody benefits from that. But in terms of the quality of schooling, I just don't see the argument. I don't see even what the mechanism would be that would say, well, state schools are better because there's this elite system alongside it that is creaming off, if you like, the kind of certainly a proportion of the more wealthy children, sometimes by scholarships, creaming off some of the more kind of academically able children, creaming off or sucking out of the state system the kind of political influence and political clout of a kind of affluent class of the kind of people who can afford to choose private schools for their kids. So it seems pretty clear to me that the existence of this elite system has a depressing effect on the quality of education in the state system. And in any case, education is a positional good. So the value to children of their education depends partly on how much other people are getting. So if you're in a competitive world competing for university places and jobs with others, you know, of your cohort, that have a simple model where people are competing with others of their cohort, then you're unlikely to do as well if you're competing with others who have just had lots more input, money, resource, time, whatever, pumped into their education because they happen to have been lucky enough to have parents who can afford to give them that kind of thing. So I think that both in this kind of, both absolutely private schools kind of reduce the quality of what's in their own estate system, and the relativities really matter here because it's in competitive context, it's how much education you have compared to others that's really the kind of crucial variable. And it looks like social mobility patterns, you know, have remained pretty constant. I mean, some people think they've got even a lot worse, but at best they've kind of remained pretty, chances for mobility have remained pretty even. And that's because of this, despite the expansion of higher education and so on. And that's because of this position, I think in large part because of this positional aspect of education.
I suspect we could talk for another hour on elite private schools, but I want to move on to another area that your research has focused on quite extensively, and that's on the role of religion in education and the degree to which you think it's appropriate for schools to educate children within a particular faith. So could you kind of set out, I think, first, what are the key questions here? What are the questions that you've looked at in your research?
So I think the questions here are, should the state be funding schools of a religious character at all? Which, as you'll know, that in the US, they don't. You know, there's a kind of really hard line between the state and religion in that way. And Americans are always kind of completely bemused when they come here and, you know, academics come and they visit for a year and they send their kid to the local school. And it's all this very often got all this religious stuff going on and they kind of can't believe that that's what's happening. So that's one big question. Then if you are going to have religious schools, the kind of, as it were, in what ways the school can educate about religion or indeed teach religion as true. So, you know, typically if you go to a faith school, that school will teach that doctrine as the truth. They won't just say, let me tell you some stuff about Christianity in case you're interested. They'll say, you know, they'll give you some doctrine. And that is, so the kind of, the way in which school, the curriculum of schools and how they should teach religion. Then there are really interesting questions about admissions policy, which I've done quite a lot of work on recently about, you know, should schools be allowed to admit just 100% children of believers in the faith that the school is kind of, you know, that is the religious, that affiliation of the school, or should they have to mix, you know, mix children from different backgrounds and so on. And then, of course, there's questions about the state versus private. Some people think the rules should be completely different in the state system from in the private system. Again, the US comes to mind there. And then there's homeschooling, which is a growing area, at least in the UK. And it's a bit of a free-for-all at the moment, to be honest. There's very little regulation and very little control of how children are raised if they're home educated. So these are the questions.
Let me start with one particular area. And this goes back, I think, to your kind of framework that you use to evaluate this. So much of your argument on faith-based schools derives from the value that you place on personal autonomy for children. Right. So that children have the right and the ability to make choices about their own future. Your argument, as I understand, is that, you know, autonomy is really important for human flourishing. But that stands in contrast to some faith traditions that might say, well, it's not really autonomy that matters for human flourishing. It's about stable, multi-generational communities. It's a right for that community to be able to induct its new members or socialize its members into the community's core beliefs. So could you talk to our audience about that kind of balance between the rights and the culture and the tradition of the community versus the autonomy of the child, which features very, very prominently in your framework?
Sure. I will. I'm just going to kind of put in the bit that we missed out, right, which is that the proposals from me and my colleagues would not allow children to be taught what we call directively a religious education. So at the moment, you can send your child to a school that will teach that religion as true. And we say you shouldn't be allowed to do that. And a lot of the reason is exactly what you're asking me about, is about this child's interest in personal autonomy, because we think that there's just too much of a threat to children's autonomy if the culture of the home is strongly religiously infused, and then the children also go to a school that reinforces, so you have great continuity between home and school. It can be for children very hard to think for themselves and to decide that actually this life that their parents have been living doesn't suit them. So the principle of autonomy, the kind of value of autonomy is it's the children's lives that are at stake here. And if they choose when they're adult to live the same kind of life that their parents maybe chose, maybe the parents didn't do so much choosing because their parents had raised them in the religion and so on. But yeah, it's a pretty fundamental liberal thought that people's lives are their own to live. And that we would say, just because you're some person's parent doesn't mean that you get to kind of control the agenda, limit their horizons, indeed, maybe, as often happens, decide that they will be a member of a certain religion, that they will have an education that raises them to be a member of that religion. This is just kind of inappropriate, because it's the child's life to live. And then philosophically, we can think about two ways. One is, if you want people's lives to go well, then on the whole, it's a good idea for them to choose for themselves how they live their lives. You know, kind of classic examples here would be maybe gay people who find themselves in a home culture and a religious community that just doesn't have a space for them to live the kind of life they want to live. Many, many women have reported the same. You know, they want to live lives that their religious community doesn't have a place for them, really. So this is about, in order for people to live well, they need to be able to choose for themselves the kind of life and not be. There may be great value in stable, multi-generational communities if people want to reproduce that, given lots of options or given information about other ways of living, great, that's fine, that's their choice. But it's got to be their choice, and they have to have other options available to them. And then the other argument isn't so much about if you want people's lives to go well, make sure they choose autonomously. The other argument just says, look, even if their lives aren't going to go better, it's their life. You know, it's their life. You have to respect their moral standing as somebody living their own life, and you have to equip them with the resources, skills, knowledge that they need to make their own choice among the many, many ways that people, human beings, have chosen to live.
Let me see if I can get you to draw out something that might sound like a contradiction in your argument. So you argue that there should not be religious instruction in state-supported schools, but you talk about it being okay for schools to have a particular religious ethos. So can you clarify what a religious ethos is and how that sits alongside, you know, not teaching or having, you know, religious instruction? I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah. Let's take an example. Let's make it a Jewish school. So a school could have a Jewish ethos, and that would affect kind of what the kids got to eat at lunchtime. It could affect what the children wore within some limits. But school dress code, as they say, could be informed by the religion. The school could put particular emphasis on teaching about the Jewish tradition. That's different from teaching Judaism as true. It's just saying, look, this is a Jewish school. Jews believe this kind of thing. Let me tell you some stuff about that. So that the school would have a kind of a certain character, and I'm just going to use the word ethos again, that was informed by a particular religious tradition, but wasn't directively teaching that stuff as true. And on our proposals, it and all other schools would be required to teach about lots of other religions too, and lots of things that aren't religions as well. So one of our proposals is for what we call a civic, religious, ethical, and moral curriculum. At the moment, in the UK system, religion has very kind of distinctive and special standing for historical reasons, because of the history of the way the education system emerged out of the church. And we want to kind of dethrone religion. Religious lives are one way, some ways of living, but there's lots of ethically minded people who are, you know, thinking hard about how to live their lives and how they should treat others, but not doing it out of a religious tradition. So we want to kind of introduce this kind of civic, ethical, and moral religion education alongside religious. So all these schools would be teaching that, what we call CREAM syllabus. That's the acronym: civic, religious, education, ethical, and moral. Now, why do we allow the ethos at all? Doesn't that look like a contradiction? Well, to be honest, the main reason we think state schools should be able to have an ethos is because, as things stand, parents have the option of taking their kids out of the state system and either educating them privately or at home. And when you devise policy, you've got to kind of take feasibility constraints seriously. What you don't want to do is have a kind of completely, you don't want to have a school system where religiously minded parents are just not going to send their kids there at all. So the idea, in a way, you can think of it as a kind of compromise, you know, really. But the idea is, well, let's have religious ethos schools, which might be sufficiently religious to kind of keep religious families in the state system. Make them there, have this general education in religious, ethical, moral curriculum. And that's really the idea. It's a kind of keeping in the state system parents who might otherwise opt out. Whether philosophically they should be allowed to opt out, we don't address that. In other work, I suggest that they shouldn't. But in the policy proposal work that I do, and this is a quite interesting feature of policy proposal work, that it needs to be more pragmatic, it needs to be more realistic. There, the suggestion is that we should allow this kind of religious ethos. But another bit of our proposal is that schools shouldn't be allowed to select 100% on the basis of religion. So these schools may have a religious ethos, but they can't by design be just full of Jewish children or Muslim children or Christian children or whatever. If other people want to go to these schools, they have to be allowed in. Only 50% is our proposal can be selected on a religious basis.
Adam, I think that takes me to my final question, and you've already gotten us there, but you've written a lot of the books that we've talked about in the beginning of the podcast, but several pamphlets that are really designed to be accessible to non-academics and to policymakers. And I wanted to ask you about your influence. Do you feel like the work has had an influence on policy debates or policy making within these matters?
No, not really, honestly. I think it's had some influence on, it's kind of helped Guardian readers kind of see why they believe what they believe and understand the kind of the philosophical structure of their views, which is not, I think, not a negligible kind of thing to do. And I know that kind of civil servants, as it were, people, so in the policy domain, they think about work in the kinds of ways, and they find the kinds of work that I do useful. But, you know, they're subject to their political masters, typically. And there, I would say, there's no real sign of anybody kind of saying, oh, yeah, you know, Adam Swift and his colleagues were right, we should abolish elite private schools. You know, one's kicking against the current in these, if you ask me why, I would say, because I think pro-parental ideology is deeply entrenched in our society. I think we just think that parents should get to control their children's lives And so is kind of, you know, using your resources to benefit you and yours as much as you possibly can. That view is also widely shared, and put the two together and you get all the things that I'm arguing against on the whole.
Do you think that recent debates that we've had kind of collectively as a society, you know, post-pandemic, but even pre-pandemic, around inequality and rising inequality and greater awareness of inequality, does that break down this kind of, you know, elite consensus on the value of elite private schools, or the kind of pro-parental rights that dominate this space? Is there any inroad there, or are we in the same place that we were in the 70s when you talked about this being a really, you know, kind of vibrant and vital discussion?
I hope so. I hope so. I just wrote something. There's a collection coming out. I think it's called Pandemic Philosophy. It's kind of a bunch of political philosophers, moral philosophers writing about the pandemic. And I wrote something called, I think it was called Pandemic as Political Theory. And the kind of conceit was that we could hope that the pandemic, we could treat the pandemic as teaching us some lessons in political theory, some things that political theorists have been going on about years and years and years, but are kind of made so vivid and so stark that the extent of the inequalities, the exacerbation of the inequalities, the, you know, the ethnic dimension, the gender dimension. So it's like inequality and injustice are being kind of thrust in our face more and more and more. And one can hope that eventually at some point people will say enough, you know, this is, you know, we don't want to go on like this. But, you know, I read my newspapers, I read my opinion polls, you know, I see what kinds of policy are being proposed. I see what, you know, for example, the government's recent kind of, you know, this very small amount of money they're willing to spend on catch up education for the children who've been kind of disadvantaged by the pandemic. These are children who are already disadvantaged. These are extra disadvantaged by the pandemic, and it just doesn't seem to be a priority. So I'm not optimistic. I work in ideal political theory. I work in kind of quite an idealistic way, but that doesn't make me an optimist about kind of what's going to happen out there.
We have to stop there, Adam. We'll make sure that our viewers have access to all the scholarship that you've produced in this area and the pamphlets, but also the recent work you've just cited. Thank you very much, Professor Adam Swift. Next week, we'll be asking, should public officials be chosen by politicians, or should they be appointed solely on merit? We'll explore that question with our colleague, Professor Christian Schuster, whose research spans a number of countries around the world on this important question. Remember to make sure that you don't miss out on future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics. All you need to do is subscribe, and you can do that on Apple, Spotify, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Jennifer Hudson. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you very much for listening.